We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 863. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. Whatever kind of digital thing you need to represent yourself or your ideas, whether you want to sell stuff, whether you just want to put your feelings into the world or just talk about a thing that you love, whatever, blog it. Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into a reality, including a free domain. Not to mention, with Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features, creating that beautiful thing that represents who you are digitally is a simple and intuitive process. Just add and arrange your content with a click of a mouse. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com. Use the offer code NERDIST to get 10% off your first purchase. Katie Levine's got a corkboard. It's from the community. Did you just drop your...
I did. I dropped my phone.
You dropped your corkboard, which yes, is essentially your phone.
The band Dirty Love, who loves listening to our podcast, is performing at D Piazzas in Long Beach, California, Friday, April 14th. They've been together for 8 years, and this is their first official bar show, so they really are excited about it, and they want to make it memorable, and they want people to come out. Price is $10, but if you say you're there for Dirty Love, you get in for $8. There's pizza and beer, so find out more info by going to dpiazzas.com or dirtylove.co. Also, John Swindle writes, I'm an intern at the A.W. Perry Homestead Museum, a small historic home museum in Carrollton, Texas. It's a suburb of Dallas. And he's developing a historical program for the museum. And he wanted to make it about vintage baseball events. So any sports nerds who want to learn more about the history of baseball in the Dallas or Fort Worth area, you should definitely go check it out. They're going to have a lot of speakers, a lot of different information about the history of baseball. It's from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on April 15th. It's for all ages. And you're going to learn a lot of info. It looks really cool. So you can go to cityofcarrollton.com/museum. And that's CARROLLTON.
All right. I have one that I'd like to throw in the corkboard. This was sent to me on got a little PM on Reddit, but I wanted to share this. So there's an Indiegogo campaign. There's some young filmmakers by the name of Cody Langtree, Zena Haggerty, and Jessica Sovey. They are all putting together a documentary called Women's Work, A History of Women in Coding. And there's an Indiegogo for it right now. This is from the Indiegogo page. From the first program to sending humanity to the moon, the work done by women in the field of computing has pushed us all forward into the now and into the future. Given the immense disparity in numbers between men and women active in and entering the field of computing and STEM fields in general, we believe it is imperative to create a mainstream documentary film that showcases the breadth and depth of the immense female contribution to the world of computer programming. So they have the Indiegogo up right now. Women's Work, A History of Coding, and go.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's
right?
Great.
Also, if you watch Talking with Chris Hardwick this Sunday night, part of the cast of Silicon Valley will be on.
Yeah.
So that'll be a Sunday night AMC, 11 p.m. We are in full swing now, people. all right. So I'm very excited about this podcast, Katie. My dear friend from G4, Blair Herter, mm-hmm. reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to talk to a guy who he works at SoftBank, but his whole role is to work in robotics and bring robots into our lives. He used to work at Ubisoft. Now he works at SoftBank. And I said, yeah, yeah. When we can have scientists and technology advocates on, and people who are putting technology, weaving them into our lives. Yes, I absolutely would like to talk to him. So Steve Carlin, who, by the way, listens to the podcast and was a fantastic guest, is promoting Pepper the robot.
Yeah.
So if you go to meetpepper.com, Pepper is basically, just a robot that would theoretically handle domestic services, I suppose, or just and I actually saw Pepper. I engaged with Pepper when Lydia and I were in Japan on our honeymoon. I got to meet Pepper in a department store. So go to meetpepper.com. And thanks to Steve Carlin for coming on and discussing robotics with us here on the Nerdist Podcast, which was also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to? I don't know why I just made it sound like a. Are you hiring? It just sounded like I was going like a legit commercial. Yeah. Are you hiring you? In your car? Why, yes, I am. Well, did you know where to post your job and find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. ZipRecruiter already has 9 million resumes. You can search through their database. You can add multiple people to your account to make it the most efficient way for your team to find the best hire. You can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook, Twitter, all with a single click. They make it easy for you. It's very intuitive. It's simple. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire them the right person fast. And if you run into issues, ZipRecruiter's friendly and human support staff is ready to help. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been featured on Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, New York Times, TechCrunch, CBS, and why it's been used by over 1 million businesses. Right now, Nerdist Podcast listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Nerdist. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 863 with Steve Carlin. KT, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome.
It's a good game.
Oh.
I'm a Montana guitar player also.
Oh my gosh. You just found your soulmate, right. Matt. Thanks. Another person who understands your pain.
There's a few of us out there.
Well, maybe. Steve, I don't know. Are you fine with just one guitar, or do you feel like you need to have 30 guitars?
I was fine with one, and now I've just gotten a second acoustic to go with my two electrics, so my wife's beginning to wonder what's going on.
Matt's gonna probably make you trade emails so you guys can swap guitars.
And there's a few of us out there that we share text chains. And, I'll see something on Reverb, and I'm like, here.
So allegedly, I was telling him that I have a friend at Gibson that's kind of helped me out get these, and the first songwriter I got was allegedly on the West Coast for Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Oh my God!
He's like, we had this out here in KC.
Now, what happened to Gibson? What it was? Did Gibson make the robot guitar? I saw that at CES one year. Was it Gibson?
Yes,
it was Gibson. Yeah. It was basically
Explorer.
Firebird
X.
It was basically a self-tuning guitar.
Yeah, we had one on Attack of the Show.
I remember,
and it disappeared.
What? Oh, it did.
Not mine.
I
don't have it.
It wasn't left-handed.
So I know where it is, but it's long gone.
I didn't take. Wow, this is. Are we gonna get a ransom note now?
Yeah. No, but the listen. They Gibson has tried many times in the past to.
Why is something like a robotic guitar not a bigger seller? It seems to me that having a guitar,
guys love vintage stuff.
That can play itself.
Itself, and then not only just play itself, but also tune itself into any tuning.
That's what it did. That was very cool. And they have those robo tuners now. They sell a lot of their stock.
Right, where you put it onto
on
the
neck.
You put it onto the tuning.
It comes on there now.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, most of the Gibson line has the robo tuners. It's great if you're in and out of tunings. And you don't know how to tune your car. I want to do open G, and then you want to go back to regular tuning. It's great if you're in like a band and you're a guy doing that, but a lot of guys.
There's also apps for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but it's still. This is one of those things where I kind of don't mind. I wouldn't mind, I'm sure some people appear as like, no, man, if you don't tune it by hand and
not
your ear.
Not some people. Most people.
Most people. Well, and they're not. I don't think they're right. I think this is where we need to. This dovetails nicely into you being here, Steve, but just the idea of, what do we need to be philosophically okay with machines doing and machines basically weaving into our art? And does that make it less artistic if there is a machine involved? Does that make it not, because it's too – machines are too precise. Are they too precise to be artistic?
Well, autotune would be a similar –
Yes, but autotune sucks.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think
it sucks when you notice it.
Right.
You know, it's. I'm sure there's times when you're hearing a song and it's auto-tuned and you don't.
Is it true? Is it true about the story about like why that song, that Cher song, is that they were trying to auto-tune her voice so hard that it skipped and that's why it went and then that like became the.
I don't know. I've not heard that legend, but that makes sense. That was the first song you really ever heard.
Katie, look
it
that
on.
Up. I heard the rumor was a friend of mine. who worked in music said, "Oh, that's because they were trying to auto-tune that her voice so hard that it like it jumped because it couldn't, you know, like auto-tune can stretch, but then it just broke." And they're like, "Well, that sounds pretty cool. Let's leave that in."
Well, they got it. Yeah, is that my phone?
No, someone's phone is interfering.
Is it my phone? No, my phone's off.
Gone.
My phone.
Is it Steve because he's actually a robot? He actually has robot guts.
I'm trying to figure that out. What about auto-tune? Do you want me to look up?
Look up the Cher song.
Cher did Cher auto-tune? Was that intentional? Was the Cher auto-tune intentional on Life Drive? So back to you, Steve. the robot precision artistic argument. Where do you fall?
On whether robots should be able to tune your guitar?
Well, I just mean in terms of like robots kind of fusing into our art.
I mean, I think we will have purists and we should have purists. And then who's to say that robots doing art isn't art?
Well, I mean, whenever Data tried to act or play the cello, it was a little weird on Star Trek.
That's true. Because he couldn't feel.
Yeah. He could just do a precise recreation of a performance he had already heard.
But isn't that what most people do when they're learning to play anyway? They're doing a precise performance of something.
I don't want
to
get into this.
I've seen a couple Instagram videos where you're just playing along with songs that already exist.
Yeah.
That's kind of the same thing.
I mean, it is, but I'm not an Android.
I don't know that.
So you're kind of... It says, we're working on this Cher on the song Believe. The producers discovered that if they set autotune on the most aggressive setting so that it corrected the pitch at the exact moment it received the signal, the result was an unsettling robotic tone.
Yeah. Sounds like it was a mistake that they...
It sounds like it was kind of on purpose, but...
I think it was on purpose. I'm going to guess it was on purpose after
very clear.
They discovered it.
I just love the look on her face when you're like, look that up. She's like, why? How do you look that up?
By
the
way,
this is much better than Lake Wobegon. This is much better than Lake Wobegon.
So you're saying Lake Wobegon does not have Star Wars wallpaper? Yeah.
And I was told I should only answer yes and, right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's the improv training. That's the improv training.
Yes, I was the lights guy in theater high school.
Oh, were you really?
So I saw.
Theater sports, you know how it works. So going from lights guy, what was your first job? Because I know you worked in gaming for a while. You were at Ubisoft.
Yeah, I was at Ubisoft and Facebook for gaming. I came out of college with a degree in geology, which seemed like such a good idea at the time.
Sure. What was the plan?
I was going to get a job outdoors.
Sure.
That's about as far as I made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that really what you become is a pack mule carrying rocks around. And
you can just do that anyway.
That also didn't seem like a good plan. So I went and worked nonprofit for a little while just trying to think about what to do. And then went back to grad school, and that was the key.
But then what got you into gaming? Did you come in through the marketing side?
I get this question all the time. How did you must have wanted to get into gaming? And the reality is I had no plan to get into gaming. I came out of grad school to Procter & Gamble and then to Energizer, so packaged goods. And what is so interesting is I started working with Procter's Walmart team. So I was literally living in Fayetteville, as we called it.
Oh, yeah, Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Fayetteville, Arkansas. You've been there probably to do
shows, many times.
Right?
It's actually a good – I really like
really
it a lot. Yeah.
It's a really good town. People go there kicking and screaming, and then they don't want to leave.
It's a great town.
So we really enjoyed living there, my wife and I. But of that team, there's 200 people of that team. I could name 9 people that went to either EA, Activision, or Ubisoft.
Oh, wow.
And what happened was the Wii came out, and the Wii all of a sudden hit a much different demographic than had previously been hit, mom and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so now things like Target and Walmart became important. And Amazon, to a lesser degree at the time, became important. And these companies recognized, oh, my goodness, we don't know how to go sell to those locations. Because that's an entirely different skill set, really, when you're talking about Walmart versus, say, GameStop, right? So it was really interesting. But I got there because they needed to up-level sort of how they thought about marketing.
And then – so what is – I think when most people hear marketing, their eyes roll back in their head or they just don't really know what it is. And it's very interesting because I feel like now – everyone who is of the digital generation has a degree of marketing skill because of social media.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a different part of marketing altogether.
Right.
So when I was doing that, social media wasn't even a thing. So that wasn't even a skill set we had to worry about. This was more about understanding when Chris or Matt walks into a retail setting, for example, how do you need to speak to them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality is, you guys probably already know this, there's nothing done in that store by chance.
Right.
And so, you know, there's literally billions of dollars spent in the marketing messages that are being delivered to you just while you walk through a Walmart.
Oh,
because
yeah.
There's 130 million people walk through that Walmart every month.
I remember there was a show I was pitching maybe like 12 years ago with a production company, and it was all about the whole concept of the show was about hidden math. Where we were pitching Discovery. We were not pitching this to a major network. We were pitching this to Discovery, not like one of the big four. But I was really fascinated by the idea of there being math in places where most people don't realize there are math. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It's like when a mall is laid out statistically, what types of stores do better in proximity to one another to generate sales, or going into a department store and understanding. You know, it's like Bed Bath & Beyond. Why these impulse magnets next to this obviously was a math problem that someone figured out about a human behavior.
Yeah.
So this idea of – and I think it weaves pretty interestingly into the concept of robotics and predictable robot behavior. But what is the math behind – some of the math, if you understand some of the math behind how like a department store is laid out.
So there's a gentleman by the name of Paco Underhill, and he wrote a book called Why We Buy. And he actually has an entire firm, and you can hire them out, and they will literally go stalk shoppers through a store and very sort of surreptitiously say, okay, Matt walked in the store. He stopped within 5 feet. You know, he did not pay attention to any of the signage that was there. Then he moved 15 more feet while he was getting his shopping list out, and then he turned right. Actually, you turned left because you're left-handed. But, you know, 80% of people turn right.
Oh, wow.
And they literally go through the store and say, okay, then here's how they shop the store on a grid. Therefore, anything that's facing the aisle at the very end from that angle is better than the opposite side.
Oh, wow.
And so you work your way through the store and you do that. We actually did that within a GameStop. And we started to realize, you know, they're charging you. So I'm looking around at your posters around it. They charge you for this space. And so you have to say to yourself, all right, well, which space actually is better than other space? Because you don't know.
Oh, you mean like to put up a Ubisoft?
Right. So when you see
like
an, right. So if you see an end cap, that's right. Right. So you've got behind the cash register, you've got these posters right there.
Right.
And then you've got end caps and you've got little side caps and all sorts of caps. There's lots of caps in these stores.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to figure out, well, if I have such and such a budget, which do I buy at any one point in time? And gaming, a little different than, say, classic packaged goods, simply because, and you guys know this better than most, you're trying to make such a big splash, right? Because you've only got a 90-day window to sell probably 90% of your volume.
Right.
And if you don't, it's gone, right? So you are definitely overdoing it a bit, but you can also overspend and not get the return. And so we used this company, Paco Underhill's company, to literally walk through a GameStop store, have people put glasses on and see where their eyes went. So you could see not only which things they saw, but what about the thing. So I'm looking at a Chevy Chase poster.
Yes.
Immediately your eyes will go to his eyes because you're trained as a human to go look at facial features, right?
Right.
And so we notice like Assassin's Creed, you know, whether it's Ezio or any of the other characters, people always went to their faces. And so our key art, which we then use our agency for, needs to make certain that the faces are prominent. So not only should we not buy certain places, but we need to make sure the art looks a certain way.
Oh, wow.
So these are the numbers, right? And basically, you've got 5 seconds from 5 feet to make an impression. And if you don't, it's gone because everything else is retail noise, right? Shopping is about deselecting, not selecting. So you have to figure out which department is my stuff in. Okay, I don't need that department. I don't need that department. I need this department. Okay. What in this department do I don't need that. I don't need that. Ah, this is what I'm looking for.
Well, not only that, but now with people's faces in their phones, they're paying attention even less to what's going in the sources. Mm-hmm. Does that affect how, you know, are people more singularly purposed when they walk into a retail establishment because they come there for a reason and then the rest of the time they're just looking at their, you know, whatever's
on
their phone?
Well, what it does do is it makes the likes of Google search that much more important.
Sure.
Because contextually then you should be getting a different result. So, example, Chris walks down the olive oil aisle, he shouldn't get this is the vineyard that the olives were picked from, and it's a 1,000-year-old vineyard in Italy. It should be, here's how you use our olive oil in your dinner tonight, because that's why you're there.
Right.
Right? So contextually, you should be getting a very different message than you would, say, normally if Katie were to go search olive oil right now.
Well, I think what's even going to be more – it's going to be more crowded for the human brain is as more AR stuff gets integrated. There was a really great – there was a really great thing I saw at CES like 5 years ago, and I really thought it was going to be – the next big thing. I would have lost a ton of money putting money into it, but it was all, it was essentially a way to, the company was, it was, they were selling inductive charging services and inductive charging services. And so they had these, they had a grocery store shelf mocked up and it was coated in this inductive surface, charging surface. And then the boxes had, basically, printed boxes with ink that had an electric charge in it. And so the boxes would light up like Vegas signs. And to me, I thought, oh, my God, that's going to be insane. That's going to – but that feels like a very analog way to – I feel like we're past that now because of AR. So what's AR going to do?
It's also like Blade Runner. Like everything's going to be like, whoa, what's moving? And so many lights and just
– So what? So how is AR going to even further splinter our already splintered attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think whether you're talking AR or robotics, what you're not doing is putting your face in the phone, like you're saying, right? So the CEO at Snap made a really interesting point. He said, "Look, the mobile device is a wall between us and our reality and our world, right? It's this thing that's now in front of us. So what robotics helps with, and I think AR to a large degree would as well, is get rid of that barrier and allow you to experience the world again with still getting the information that you need."
Sure.
So I think AR could be a really interesting tool in a retail setting, assuming that the retailers can actually put that in, because there's a little bit of work behind the scenes that needs to be done. But whether it's a retail setting or a hospitality setting or an automotive setting or even healthcare, like there could be really interesting uses for AR.
I mean, think about if you had AR at a baseball game.
That's right.
And you could just look down at the field and see all the player statistics and then see how he hits this guy and so on and so forth. See where his last 14 hits went in the stadium. Like it would just be
the pitch count. It could be all sorts of really interesting.
Get on that.
But it does It does make me wonder. It does make you use them as a suggestion box. There you go.
Get on that. Hey, go tell the people.
She told me to turn my phone off or I would be taking
notes. It kind of makes me wonder how much the human brain can actually take and process. That at a certain point, you know, there is a finite capacity for how much we can actually understand and process before our brain just starts leaking out of our ear.
It becomes that important that the cloud that's pulling from is doing its job, so that it's condensing down that information to the salient points. Because you're right, you can be overloaded very quickly. And anyone who's done data analysis knows you can have analysis paralysis, right?
But I mean, how do you even know which data points to look at and which ones are relevant?
Because it's learned, right? So deep learning would allow you to understand which data points are important, you know, based off of 3 million different examples, right? And then AI actually makes it better than that, because AI isn't the same thing as deep learning, right? So, you know, AI could maybe bring it down to more like 300 points of data that then tell you what you're looking at. So
I have a weird philosophical question, which is, you know, with AI, because a lot of what we're going to talk about today is Pepper the robot, which I think I actually encountered when I was in Japan in August.
Yeah.
I went into a department store, and I'm pretty sure that I'm 100% positive that Pepper photographed me. Like there was a Pepper unit, and I walked up and I appeared on its chest. And then it took a picture of us. I feel like I have that. I feel like I have that somewhere. So I believe
it's
have
very popular in Japan.
So I have encountered Pepper in a retail setting.
Right. You would for sure.
But so we are spending so much time trying to teach robots to think in quote unquote natural ways, the way a human reasons, I suppose. But does that make sense? Because a robot has, you know, compared to us, a near infinite capacity for processing information. Not infinite, but compared to us, I feel like. So, you know, humans can only focus on one thing at a time, really. So how do you is it an incorrect approach trying to teach a robot to understand things like humans, because we're more limited than they are in terms of what we can understand?
And I want to be clear, I'm not an AI specialist. I think we covered the fact that I have a degree in geology.
Yes. But you are working.
But I think it literally has to do with how you want to program it. You know, and whether you want to get into the ethics of what should robots be able to do or not, it's all about how you choose to program the robot. So if in the instance that you're trying to solve for, it makes the most sense to have the robot think like a human, then that's the way you're going to program it. If not, then I feel certain these guys would come up with a different way to approach the same problems.
Or the robots become self-aware.
Or they become self-aware.
There's no way that's not going to happen.
That's a whole different...
Well, they're going to start programming the new robots.
They're going to program the new robots, and then they're going to start programming...
Program the way they want.
Well, you know what's going to happen is if we teach robots how we think, they're going to understand our psychology, and so then they're going to start conditioning us to do things because they understand the very simple pain-pleasure principles that we work off of.
Well, it's interesting... Matt and I were talking about this video game called Rocksmith, and there's a mode within it where you can play, just jam, right? And you can pick certain instruments, and the instruments will come in and play behind you. So as you speed up, they speed up. As you slow down, they slow down. But you can also respond to what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this loop, and it's kind of what you're talking about, like – effectively, the AI of the game is figuring out...
They'll start realizing that we're pets.
Yeah.
And that they can train us
and
like
in my
pets.
Case, that I suck at guitar.
Well,
and that's, they need
also,
to come in harder.
You're also putting a desire. You're like, you're presupposing that they'll have a desire to do anything.
Yeah, that's right.
They might just want to do what they're programmed to do and have no desire to go outside of that comfort zone.
Yes, I know. But basic cinematic robotic law tells us that... They understand efficiency and at a certain point realize how inefficient we are and how much more efficient
I'm
they
sorry,
are.
I'm sorry, Skynet engineer number three. I forgot.
We never would have guessed this conversation would get here that fast, right?
This fast.
This is exactly where we thought this was going.
No, but it's exactly – I mean, you know, trying to understand how these machines – I mean, you know, if you go into the – if anyone goes into the Prelinger archives – online, you can, you know, you can see films from the 1950s you know, late 40s, like, in the future, robots will do all of our work, you know, and they have this giant refrigerator-sized lumbering robot that would legitimately fall and kill someone in the house. But, you know, for decades, for over half a century, we've been promised, you know, some type of an automaton is going to do all our work for us. So... You know, what has been – and I remember growing up, you could – you know, Radio Shack would have like, oh, here's a little unit that you can take home and it does things, quote unquote. It can bring you a drink, but it's like all the steps required to get it on the tray and get it, you know, and navigate. We just didn't –
As long as you've already put the drink on the tray.
Yeah, put the drink on
only
the tray.
Only at 2.5 feet high.
It only has to go like a couple feet itself, then, you know, it's going to work.
Yeah.
So what – you know, why do you think – or even seeing, you know, like the what is it, Asimo? Like, you know, tumble down the stairs and the one, you know. So, what do you think it is that is finally getting us into a place where we're ready for this?
Well, there's are we ready for it just as people, and then there's are we ready for it technologically? And it's actually interesting, you know, having left Facebook to come to this job, I didn't really think too much about the consumer perception, more particularly the perception of robotics that's fueled by pop culture, right? And so we have a really interesting communication and marketing challenge ahead of us with Pepper, because the reality is Pepper is not C-3PO and it's not going to be C-3PO anytime soon. But yet the expectation of people in the Tokyo Mall, like you were, is, oh my God, this thing can talk. So let's just have a conversation.
Right.
And so they just start, you know, staccato asking questions, and we've programmed enough of the questions to somewhat get an answer. But the reality is, you can quickly outstrip its capabilities by having, you know, too meaningful a conversation, right? That's just not how the software works. So the reality is we're ways off from it being, you know, a robot that can work in your house and really the way we're thinking about it,
right?
Or you know, perform anything more than a very specifically programmed action. But that's okay, because if you think about where it was when we were kids, and we're about the same age, so I mean, we didn't have Pepper.
No.
There's no way you had Pepper, right? You had things that could talk, or they
2XL.
Could or they could film you,
right?
Or they could move on arm, but they couldn't do all those things,
right?
And so that is a good example of how far we've come, and we will continue to go, because think about who's playing now: Facebook, Google, Intel.
Well, yeah, and also, right? I mean, and also, social media, particularly Facebook, has probably, I don't even know, like, petabytes of data of human interaction and human behavior, which if they could, you know, somehow theoretically just upload every interaction that human beings have had on their platform, would instantly be able to teach something about how humans think and behave, and right. you know, because a robot could, I mean, some type of AI, I would imagine, could parse a lot of that data faster than a human being could. So is there, yeah. is there, do you think there's anything with social media? I wonder if maybe it's not robots become self-aware, it's social media itself becomes social, becomes self-aware.
I think if it ever does, it'll shut itself down. For the good of it.
It'll just get into a flame war with itself, and then just its core will melt.
I've muted all of you.
The back door will have been triggered.
I'm blocking you.
Yeah, no, I think you make a really good point, which is there's exceptional amount of data on these social media sites. So if anybody has at their fingertips the ability to go mine the data, the question becomes, do you have an AI that can do that, or is it really deep learning? And again, deep learning is about taking millions of data points that are similar and trying to establish the pattern from it, right? And so oftentimes when you're trying to solve a solution, you can only solve that solution with that data. It can't then be used, that algorithm, or it can't then be used to do a different solution. It was designed specifically to say, can you identify what a bottle of water looks like?
Mm-hmm.
And so once it's done that, you can't say, okay, now identify the Stradivarius sound. It has to be modified to go do that, right? It's not as simple as, oh, well, once it can identify something, it can identify anything. That isn't quite how it works.
Sure, it's going to be some type of a quantum formula.
Right.
But
something came out just like today about, oh, well, Google or one of them has developed a way to start to do that, which will be a breakthrough in upon itself. So
what do you think is the...
We're going way deeper into technology. She's like giving me the look like, you're not the technologist.
We don't have to. I mean, this is an open conversation. Yeah. This is sort of what we, you know, I mean, you don't have to know everything. If you did, we would be convinced that you are a machine and not a human being. But I'm you don't have to talk about the technical specifications of how it's going to work. But I think the philosophical questions of, you know, can it be done and should it be done and how will it be done and what will that do? You know, I mean, I assume humans will just sort of adjust to whatever at this point. We're so used to, I mean, you know, there was, it's really hard to imagine that there were periods of, you know, centuries where there was no human innovation really whatsoever. And now it's just, we just take
it
for
granted.
They
had a lot of mileage out of that wheel though. I'm telling you, fire was good.
Fire was really good. But now, you know, there's, you know, some type of Moore's law for everything and people just expect that it's going to be that way. And if it's not, they, you know, they get upset. I mean, I don't blame when Apple releases a phone and it's like it wasn't as dazzling as the previous two phones. Like, yeah, well, if they didn't come out with a new phone, you guys would bitch at them, and you're bitching because this one's not – you can't revolutionize the phone every year.
Yeah.
It's
worse than like tennis rackets and skis. Like, what are you expecting?
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen?
A millimeter difference in the string settings. Really. But yeah, I mean – I think with robotics, you know, we've got some really interesting things coming. So, you know, think about what you're scratching at, which is, are we going to design products or platforms that can do all these different things? And the reality is, the question is, well, is there revenue involved with it? Because for the most part, these companies aren't doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Some of them are. The Googles have so much money that they can throw an entire department after, you know, interesting moonshot type thing.
Sure.
But for the most part, the reality is these startups and what have you, there's something that they're working towards, which is, you know, either to go public and have an ongoing concern, or, you know, it's a bigger company that already has the money and now needs to see a return. So in our instance, you know, SoftBank, we know that Pepper can do certain things and not other things. And it was done very specifically to be commercializable. So a perfect example, we get the question a lot, well, so can Pepper just wander through a store, for example, and take me to the product or whatever? And sort of, yeah, it could actually do that. It has the sensors, but it would need to map out the store first, and that would go pretty slowly. And it wouldn't be an experience you'd want if you're working through a Home Depot or a Walmart. So we don't try to say that that's the use case for it. What we do try to say is when Chris Hardwick's walking through a mall and you need something to engage with him, boy, here's a robot that's got a very specific form factor designed to engage with him. Right, so it's not that monstrosity you talked about from the 60s.
No, he probably looks
not
like,
going to scare the shit out of anybody.
Looks like a TARDIS,
right?
Or a Yoda.
So it's 4 feet tall. So it's big enough to have a presence, but not so big that it's scaring off my kids.
Yoda.
And it's got a human-like-ish face, but not anything near
still
the
Yoda.
Uncanny Valley.
I'm still
right?
going Yoda.
Right. So it's not Tom Hanks in the Polar Express.
Right.
It's not spooky. It's got a little nub for a nose. Kind of cute. It's got the big anime expressive eyes.
I mean, you're just checking off the Yoda boxes left
right?
and right.
And it's got a tablet, so you can input information or be given content. And then it's got two arms, and the arms are really more about communicating with you, because when we speak with our hands. We
sure.
gesticulate. And so by mimicking that, it actually creates a much more interesting bond with you, the person it's trying to speak to. And so it's not so much designed to grab this bottle of water, and it's not so much designed to take you through the store, but it is designed to get your attention and captivate you and engage with you. And it does a really good job of that. And it does a really good job of that at a price point that actually makes sense for the marketplace. Whereas you can imagine robots that walk through the woods and snow and you know, the guys at Boston Dynamics, we have a lot of respect for. Those are amazing things that they're doing.
Those are terrifying. Some of those robots
are
terrifying.
But that's exactly what that robot does. It walks through the woods and snow.
That is, like, some of those Boston Dynamics videos just look like videos that get watched by, you know, like some sort of military cadre in a bunker somewhere.
No, it's like when it's like when Batman goes to investigate a murder, and he pulls up a video from the lab and he sees that thing walking and he's
yeah.
like, oh, fuck. Well, Alfred, I'm looking for a yeah, four-legged robot creature.
Those creepy, like, those headless cheetah robots that just, like, all terrain.
You really do spend a lot of time online. I'm impressed. I'm impressed that you that
do
you
think if they
up.
Had, like, smiley faces on them, they'd be as terrifying. I think part of what makes them scary.
Yeah, I think it would be more terrifying because that would feel like a trap.
Yeah. And also the cables they always have on them, are those for power or are those just so they don't fall?
And you know, in all those videos, both. They're constantly like okay. kicking them over just to show that they can get back up. And it's like, all right, you're just teaching them aggression.
You know, and to the layperson, you know, like myself, who hadn't really been in robotics, you're like, oh, okay. But what you don't realize is that's really freaking impressive.
It's incredibly impressive.
Like what they did to make those robots do that is really impressive. And so you can imagine, yeah, maybe you don't want a robot specifically to walk through the woods, but the fact that it can do that has applications somewhere else. So you do want it to walk through Lowe's and show you where that screw is that you can't figure out what it is,
yeah.
right? Or hey, I don't know what this battery is. Where do I find it? You know, now all of a sudden, having it be able to walk through what we call an unscripted environment is really important. So you know, that therein lies one of the rubs in robotics is if you're Toyota's welding arm, that car comes the exact same spot every time. That's scripted. You know exactly where that car door is going to be, and you can weld it, no problem. But a robot moving through this room that changes every time it comes in here, or a Lowe's where there's kids with shopping carts and moms and all sorts of things going on, that's a really different challenge. And so part of the reason we didn't really choose that as an outlet is the best system for that's a LiDAR system, which you see at the top of self-driving cars.
Mm-hmm.
You see it at the top of the Boston Dynamics stuff. And up until recently, that was a six-figure add to the equipment. And so you can imagine that if you've just added six figures on top of whatever it is you did and on top of the software, now it starts to become a price point that doesn't actually make sense for the marketplace. And so we were very choiceful in what Pepper can do. And back to your broader question, those start to be some of the calculations that have to be made as you start to think about, well, what is it a robot's really going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? So,
yeah.
So it's a little more mundane. It's not as exciting as I want it to be.
What drives the prices down? Like, what is it that drives the material prices down so that it becomes affordable?
Well, start on the hardware side. One is the number of these pieces that need to be produced. So chips. Right, so there's lots and lots of chips, so that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But you need a certain type of chip within a robot because maybe it needs to call up to the cloud, and it needs to be able to process some things and have it being brought back down, and speech and facial recognition, that sort of stuff. So you need certain types of chips. So the more other devices use those chips, the cheaper those chips become. Just average law of supply and demand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then motors. Same thing. So the hardware side's pretty obvious. The software side is what's not as obvious, because the software side can actually be incredibly expensive simply because it's all custom. That means there's manpower involved. That means you have potentially licenses you have to go get So, for example, our speech is not our speech. We just use Nuance, which is a pretty typical company, a vendor to go use for language. Same with you know, speech recognition. So the point is you start to put all that together. Next thing you know, your price point's pretty high, and you go, okay, time out. what's the use case that can afford this? Right. So then you have to go sell it as, all right, well, how, Chris, are you going to use this robot? Well, I want it to sit in here and entertain everybody. Okay, well, how many people are you going to entertain times, you know, what you just paid for the robot? You start to see what the ROI might
be. What is even what's the retail outlet for a robot? Are there going to be robot sections in Walmart? Are there going to be robot, like, or is it just like, oh, I order direct from a company?
I think there absolutely will. I mean, you think Best Buy wouldn't be interested in selling this? They absolutely would be, right? And, you know, our robot isn't quite ready to be sold at that kind of setting, but there's other robots. There's toys, yep, for sure. There's Roombas. I was just at Costco yesterday. I saw a Roomba. So, you know, it's already happening. So that isn't so much the issue. It's right. it's more what's the use case and the price point for a consumer that it makes sense for it to be in a Walmart or Target or Best Buy.
What do you think? What does a domestic robot need to be able to do? Like, how many things will it need to be able to do before people start going, you know, I think maybe I could get one of those?
But that's the $64,000 question, right? I mean, so again, you know, our robot isn't designed to go do things. It's not supposed to vacuum your floor, and it's not supposed to load your dishwasher.
Sure.
And things like that. So in that sense, you know, we aren't going to check any of those boxes. Mm-hmm. But it is meant to designed to be interacting with you and to interact with the Internet of Things type devices you have around your house. So
sure.
One of the things we showcased at CES was our connection to different devices. And so you could talk to Pepper, and Pepper could ask you some questions and then determine, in this particular instance, by using an IoT faucet, which drink you might like. So it talked to you. It said, hey, I would recommend this drink. And it triggered the faucet, and the faucet poured your drink, and here you go. And so you can imagine the lighting systems. You can imagine locks. You can imagine even potentially starting your car, all voice command through the robot. So that actually probably makes the most sense early on, because again, that's a little easier to do given we've already got IoT devices and we've already got protocols, more so than, all right, it's got to go up the stairs and then clean up the Legos in the kids' room because those kids, right?
Right.
So
it's not going to be Rosie from the Jetsons.
God, it would be amazing if it was, though.
It would be great.
Yeah.
I mean, she would cry every once in a while. She had some,
in my house.
She had some emotions.
In my house.
But they, you know, I saw a video for a, it was an Alexa type, it was being marketed to single young Japanese businessmen, and it was basically a little AI that was in the form, you know, it had it had like a holographic image that would come up, and it was in the form of like a girl, and it was basically like an AI girlfriend that would be, you could text and say, I'm coming home, and it would text you back and ask you about your day. Yeah. And so do you think some of this is going to boil down to, like, yeah, you know, people who are lonely who just want to be able to, that's not like a pet that can't talk back, to just have something talk back to them so they can hear another voice in their house?
Yeah, I think so. Again, though, is technology good enough to actually talk back to you?
Right.
And we're getting there, but it isn't quite. But I know the one you're talking about, I think it sat next to the guy's like bedside.
Yeah, that's right. It sits next to his bedside.
Because the guy's room was not even as big as this room.
That's right. Yeah,
that's right.
So real estate's very,
it's, you know, it's a different world.
They just updated PlayStation VR so that YouTube on PlayStation, you can watch the 360-degree
right.
VR videos. And you're not spoiled for choice right now in those videos. It's either some extreme BMXing, some sad news reports from New York Times, or fake girlfriend.
Oh.
Like, that's literally like all there is for choice right now on YouTube. But there's so many fake dates that you can go on in your VR helmet.
Well, I mean,
I do think
companionship is probably an area where that will be very helpful for people.
All I want to do is tour the Enterprise.
I feel like you should be able to do that.
You can. There's a guy building one with an Unreal Engine. It's called Stage 9, and I've watched him do walkthroughs on YouTube, and you can download it. And it's forcing me to seriously consider building a gaming PC. Because he does it with Oculus, and it's just like, I'm very annoyed that I'm a Mac guy.
Yeah, I've had the same.
Really bothers me.
I've had the same problem with Mac. that I can't. Are you dual platformed?
No, I'm definitely a Mac. I'm with you.
Do you VR? Have you VR'd?
Yeah. Well, so I mean, we got to see Oculus early on at Ubisoft, and then I went to Facebook, and obviously we owned Oculus. So
sure.
I mean, it still has a ways to go. You know, there's interesting discussion with actually a guy out of Ubisoft and another guy from Red Storm.
Are you guys going to port it?
No, about how long should the experience be in gaming? More than 7 minutes, people argue, is too long because it's heavy, it can cause nausea.
That was my problem.
I played through the entire...
It's so much better than it was, though.
I played through the entire Arkham VR, which is an hour.
I played Resident Evil for 15 minutes, and I had to take the thing off and reset myself.
Yeah, and I don't get motion sickness, and I was like, whoa.
Sometimes I'll put it on and play a game, and when you have it on, just playing a regular game on the PlayStation, it looks like you're just watching it on a movie screen.
Yep.
And that gets more nauseating for me than being in a VR game.
And did you feel like you could get pulled out of the game really easily because of wires or hitting your shin on the coffee table? Right? I mean,
no. You feel locked in.
Well, yeah, but there is – the units are still kind of at a place where you can feel them weighing on the bridge of your nose, and you start to sweat, and it kind of like slides around. And then when it slides around, then the light, you know, light comes from underneath the thing into the goggles. And, and if you make it too tight, then – your head's in a vice.
Yeah.
You know? So
maybe it's more than 7 minutes, but
I like to feel secure.
But, you know, I am interested to, because this kind of works into AR a little bit, which is, you know, the machines that we have now essentially force us to act like machines because we have how we have to interact with them. So, you know, it's like lumbery headgear or always having to do this. And so, what do you think is the next horizon? What do you think is the next breakthrough of, this is integrated in just the way that humans are?
I think AR has got a much bigger potential, honestly.
I've been saying that for years because seems like there are a million way you have to immerse yourself. I think it's sort of like the difference between having to watch a show or listen to a podcast. You can listen to a podcast wherever, you know, almost wherever you are. But with a show, you have to focus. With VR, you have to be in one place and kind of focus.
Right.
But with AR, it's literally the entire world can be interactive.
I mean, there's some advantages to VR, obviously, being that you can create that environment, that world, right, from scratch, which game designers are very good at doing. But insofar as utility, I mean, there's so many more things you can do with AR, right? Everything from, you know, plumber goes out and can see where the plumbing lines go, or you know, people building aircraft can see where the lines are supposed to go and where the rivets are supposed to go, and you know that's pretty impressive when you stop and think about it, just the sheer utility of that technology. So I just feel like there's probably considerably more that can be done, but it's a tough challenge.
Did I read correctly that Pepper is being taught to understand, at least be able to recognize human emotions?
Right. So it can read your face and can determine basically from your facial features, your cues and clues, roughly what state you're in. If you're smiling, you're happy. If you're frowning, you're sad. And then it can respond accordingly, right? So how it was programmed to. But it's another input into the system so that it then responds in a meaningful way. But I think that's a fundamentally different thing than a lot of robots have had. And I think it's a really interesting, you know, first go at what that can really be.
Yeah.
So, and then that facial recognition will get better and better. And so it's not just your smile, it's your frown or what have you. And then you can start to take that back to the businesses. So back to our Walmart example, you know, if Pepper is in front of an end cap for a video game, for example, and it can tell you how many people walk by, that's an important metric that they didn't have before. And then how many people stopped, and then how many people engage with the message, and then whether that message was received in a good way or a bad way because they smiled or they didn't smile.
Mm-hmm.
So now you start to gradate those impressions. That starts to become really valuable to not only the Walmarts of the world, but the brand teams that are spending the money to put those messages in.
Is that ethically weird? Because then you're sort of, I mean, I know when you're in a store, you know, you're essentially you're on private property, and that you know that they are most, you know, almost all of them have some type of closed circuit TV anyway. You know, you're being monitored. Does it feel weird or invasive, do you think, for consumers to know, like, oh, that thing just logged my reactions so that they could sell me something else? Like, does that feel weird?
I mean, unfortunately or not, that's quite literally what every other device you've got is doing.
That's true.
Yeah, so, I mean, that. that train's kind of already left the station, I'd say. But the question is, can you use that then to make the experience better? And really, if you think about what Facebook tries to do with the ads, that it literally has its own in-house advertising team to help advertisers understand how to deliver a message in that medium mm-hmm. in a meaningful way so you don't get turned off.
Right. And I don't mind – I'm not someone who minds ads. I understand that ads – power, like
you more so than
well me. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when we started putting ads on the podcast, I was worried people were gonna go, fuck you, man, what are you trying to do, you're trying to, and it's like, yeah, okay,
who are we brought to by tonight? Is it Survey Monkey?
Survey Monkey just answer a few simple questions.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, explaining to people, like, look, it actually does cost money to give away free things. You know, we employ people, we pay for, you know, we have to have the podcast hosted. Katie edits the podcast. She's, you know, she works full time on the podcast. Like, people
sounded like you were paying us when you said we have to have the podcast hosted.
Well, you bet. You guys, you get paid.
Yeah, I know. Well, you did too.
So,
thank you. Thank you very much. Awesome. I appreciate that, Steve.
Those guitars aren't paying for themselves.
They're not paying for themselves. No. It'd be great if they could.
Right.
You know, if they were robot guitars, they could go out and get job and work for one.
Man, they'd have 34 jobs.
34 jobs out there in the world. He's working at your robot guitar has been working at the Toyota factory all day. Oh, my neck. See, because it's a guitar. What?
Wow.
What?
No.
That was a good riff.
It has a heel, too. You could have done that.
I didn't know that. But I guess I don't mind ads myself because I understand, like, well, this pays for stuff and this is just part of the culture that we're in. But I do mind irrelevant and... You know, if something is going to try to tell me, like, hey, if I've made the agreement, okay, you're paying attention to what I'm doing, so you better know what I like if you're going to waste my time with this stuff.
Yeah. Well, so now you're entering a realm where the technology can understand who you are. You're a male of a certain age, and thereby deliver a message that's probably slightly different than when my 12-year-old daughter comes and sees the same product, right?
Right.
That's
interesting. So you have a 12-year-old daughter?
I do.
And do you weirdly kind of study what her behaviors are in terms of how she's interacting with things and trying to see, like, is it different than the way you – because I assume that people who are just born into technology have a much different relationship to technology than people like you and I who sort of we came into the world, you know, without it, and it slowly creeped into our lives.
Yeah, the bag phone was pretty awesome, as I recall. But
which one?
The bag phone, watching Miami Vice, right?
Oh, the bag, yes. You had to carry the suitcase those phones that you had to, like, pick up and go, hey, is someone else on this? But, you know, there were only so many people that could be on at one time.
The party line through the cell phone.
I think it was Pulsar made the one we had.
Was it?
It was a bag, it was a bagged phone. And we had to punch in a code and it was 1701 because that was the enterprise serial number.
Of course,
that was my mother did that. I didn't do that.
That's very sweet.
And
of
the millennials that just dropped off the podcast.
Yeah. So, how are they interacting?
You know, it is actually really interesting. My daughter's been to our office and programmed Pepper, no problem, right? I mean, it's not intimidating in that sense. One, the programming is relatively easy. It's a bit like GarageBand would be. Mm-hmm. So if you can make a song, you can program Pepper. But I think your point is a good one. Just there wasn't even any concern about it. She just walked right in, started doing it. No worries. Whereas, you know, you and I would circle the computer a little bit and go, I don't know if I want to get into this. This is a little off-putting. Like,
well, yeah. I mean, how are kids now in terms of are they more adept at interacting with electronics and machines than people?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually Jamie sent me a picture. We have Pepper in the Oakland airport, and I mean, the kids are the first people to go around it. No problem, right? Like, they're all over it, and they want to high-five it, and they want to touch it. Actually, that's something we didn't realize as much of is how much people want to physically touch the robots, especially the hands and the arms. And so they weren't really designed for a lot of uses
sure.
and high-fiving and fist-bumping and what have you. And so the fingers start to get a little wonky, but I mean, their kids are always the first ones around it. And so we actually try to do a lot of things. So we're in Westfield Malls up in San Francisco, and a couple of the things that we programmed it to do were things like selfies. So, like, it'll bust a pose and you take a selfie and the kids love that, and then it can dance and sing and the kids love that. I mean, it's very sort of rudimentary, almost like you'd see a Disney World kind of stuff, but and the kids love that. So you need to understand that in the setting you're in. But I think the kids don't have an issue at all. You know, I tend to watch more my wife's behavior when it comes to like shopping and how she moves around the store and what have you. But I do watch the kids and how they, you know, use their phone and how they immediately know how to use the Apple TV before anybody else does.
Do you have one of those weird now almost innate understandings of human behavior? Oh, the dog's having a nightmare. Do you have one of those weird innate understandings of human behavior now because you've studied so much the way?
Well, it's very disappointing to go shopping now because you know exactly what they're trying to do.
Could you stand in the corner of a shopping store and go, okay, that guy's probably going to go to that thing next, and oh, I see the window. Okay, so she's going to go.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the other fun fact. So we'll go back to those data. Something, it depends on who you ask. Something like 70% to 80% of the purchases you make in store were done because you ran into the product, right? You literally just saw it on the shelf and decided to buy it, not because it was on your list. And so if you know that, what do you have to do in store to make certain that your brand or your product is something that's in the consideration set? And so sometimes it's flashing things like you talked about with mm-hmm. or it's bright colors or what have you. But, you know, I think back to sort of the premise we're talking about, the robotics starts to play a really interesting role in that now. Because if nothing else, if I'm own the store, I want you to have a good experience. And a good experience for you is you found the things you wanted, you feel good about the purchases you're going to make, and they're probably at a price that made sense to you, right? Mm-hmm. There's a value equation there. So great. So how do you make it a better experience? Well, you found the things more easily. You understood what the products were. You didn't have to ask somebody. You didn't have to like wander around looking for stuff. You know, they spend a lot of time thinking about how to mitigate those issues so that you'll have a better experience. And that then leads to more sales. So it's not so much the advertising has to pay for stuff so much as you're trying to make certain that people are aware of what the value of your product is. And so that's very much what comes alive to life in a store setting, right? And so we just think robotics plays an interesting role there. And by the way, we've been talking about Pepper in retail, but that's not the only place we use it. We use it in hospitality. So you go on a cruise ship in Europe, Costa Cruise Lines, it's on the cruise ship, helping you understand how to find your way around, telling you what's happening on board ship, certainly entertaining you and doing the selfies and things like that too. But we have it in automotive showrooms. We have it in healthcare settings. We have it in, actually, you guys will appreciate this. Remember the game Brain Age? Mm-hmm. So the guys that developed Brain Age developed an application for basically dementia patients to help slow the progression of the disease. So Pepper will play effectively games with you and will help sort of engage you. And if you think about it, that's brilliant because, one, not only is it well-suited to do that, but two, it has infinite patience. It never gets upset. It doesn't matter how many times you ask the same question over and over again, Pepper will answer the question every time.
That's really interesting.
So it's actually a really interesting use case. And I think we found, just to kind of keep riffing on this, one of the things that was really interesting that we found that we maybe didn't realize going in was, you know, robotics can overcome some of the inherent things that we have as humans, right? So if I'm shopping, you walk up to me, and you say, hey, can I help you? 9 times out of 10, what am I going to say?
No, I'm good.
No, I'm good. That's exactly right. But that isn't necessarily helpful to that moment in time, but it's just more of a human-to-human issue.
Well, I say that even when that's not true. No, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Or better yet, you go in to see the doctor, and the doctor breezes in. You've been waiting in the waiting room, right, for like 15 minutes. You don't know when the guy's going to come in or the lady's going to come in. She comes bursting in. And you're like, oh, okay, we're going. And she goes, okay, I've got your results. It's this, this, and this. Do you have any questions? And you're like, no, because one, you know, you're a little intimidated because she's a really intelligent person. She's in a hurry. And you don't want to ask a dumb question because you feel intimidated by that, right?
So, and you're still probably just processing the information that was just given to you.
And, you know, that was not the diagnosis you were hoping for. And
right.
And so,
right.
So I think what's been really interesting is, for example, Eli Lilly has used Pepper to help explain what a bone density scan does, especially for older women that might be experiencing osteoporosis. So by explaining what the scan does, it takes a little bit of the confusion and mystery out of it, and they're more likely to schedule the bone scan, which is helpful to them. And yes, ultimately probably leads to a prescription of a bone density drug, which of course Eli Lilly makes. So fine, yes, there's certainly some commerce there, but it actually did some good in the process. GE actually does the same thing to help explain how an MRI machine works. So Pepper takes you through, here's what the MRI machine does. That clicking and clanging sound that you're going to hear and the fact that there's something right there shouldn't scare you. That's normal. You know, it's a giant magnet and it's doing this or whatever it explains. But the point is, they understood that the bedside manner maybe wasn't always what it could be and that there was stress involved, and stress is antithetical to getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were able to address that through robotics. And I just think that's really interesting. We're right on the cusp of what that can mean.
Well, you don't even really know. I mean, it's not even really until it goes to mass market that you understand that people start figuring out new ways for it to be modified or just to be used.
Right.
And that is kind of you don't really know until it just starts getting out there and people start getting to play with it. I mean, it's almost, you know, it's when we were growing up, it's just so things are just so different now in terms of it's just like beta is almost a permanent state of being for technology because it constantly evolves and you don't know what's going to happen when things get out there in that many units.
Yeah, one of the important things that we're doing right now, and hopefully there's some folks that will listen to this, is, you know, to your point, we want the people that are developers to come onto this platform and bring their creativity, because the reality is they know so much more about whatever industry they're a part of or what they're passionate about. You know, so maybe they're an engineer, but they're also a guitarist. I don't know what kind of interesting solutions that you could utilize Pepper for in that setting, but they'll figure it out. Mm. And that's what's so amazing. So, you know, we're a little bit early insofar as a bit like the iPhone when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
It's great hardware. It's got great potential, but now we need the creativity of the development community to come on. So that's, you know, that's one of the things that we're actively doing right now. And it's not only are we setting up the North American market literally logistically to figure out how to get Pepper around, but we're also trying to bring these developers on and say, listen, you tell us about your creativity. So we're at TechCrunch Disrupt and we're hosting hackathons and we have Silicon Valley Robotics. You know, we host them at our offices and one, we're meeting some incredible people, but you know, two, you know, we're so excited to see what they're going to bring. You know, we'll be at Silicon Valley Comic-Con too.
Oh, great.
So you know, have a couple panels there and we'll be talking
about that's Wozniak's con, isn't it? Or yeah, he owns a piece of it if he doesn't own the whole thing, but I think Wozniak is, yeah.
Fingers crossed we'll have Pepper with him and we'll you know, maybe kick off the show or however he'll have us,
right?
You
could give one to a podcast.
Absolutely. You could, I'm just throwing this out, just bannering it around, you could give one to a podcast.
Maren
see what
would
they
love
could
it.
Do.
Great. Wait, what?
No, I think we should give it to Mark.
Only
Maren.
If it's shaped like a cat.
Yeah.
I feel certain Katie could do a lot.
Well, you know what we should do is that I created a festival that's going to be at the Shoreline.
Yes,
and
I heard that on
your
podcast.
You should have a demo there because the core of it is essentially going to be like a Comic-Con Maker Fair type thing.
That's coming up soon though, right?
June 24 and 25. So I think, I mean, if you have, you know, listen, if you got an extra Pepper lying
we'll
around.
People talk to you. We'll have Pepper's people talk to your people and see.
Pepper,
see.
Teach Pepper to do stand-up.
The only thing is Pepper is not as well suited for outdoor.
Gotcha.
Simply because of the sensors. So the what looks like the eye is actually almost like a Kinect sensor.
Mm.
And so direct sunlight doesn't do quite as well.
Gotcha.
So maybe under a tent, but. Yeah,
we'll have a few tents. I mean, there'll be some place for people to
There's
look.
There's got to be some tent, Chris.
I mean, we'll build a tent.
I think there'll be a tent.
We'll build a tent for this
If
robot.
You build a tent,
he will come. Just marching all the way down from
Well,
there.
I mean, it's more like a roll, really, than a march.
A little bit of a roll.
Yeah.
So what do you think, like, where is it all? Where do you think this is all going? What's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen? I mean, you must have a 100 years from now, like, some sort of a vision. What do you think is going to happen, and what do you want to happen?
Yeah, so you know, I'm sort of tasked with being the chief strategy officer now, so I have to kind of figure this out. I think what we're going to see is so first robotics will start to fit in certain use cases, right? And we've seen this already. So mm-hmm. Industrial and automotive kinds of applications were pretty obvious. Now we're starting to say, okay, well consumer wise, what can happen? And you know, I think there's still a lot more that needs to happen with the technology because the expectation, again, is so high. But you will continue to see robots coming to the home. So now they're very focused on a specific utility, like sweep your rug.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that makes sense. So now you connect them with what? What else could be connected to it or what could control that? And I think what you'll start to see is that ecosystem starts to grow around some of those specific use cases, or like we're postulating, maybe there's a robot that starts to control those different things. And so you have a chief information officer of your home.
Right.
Right. So it is data mm-hmm. in a sense, though that.
But it is interesting though, because
it's
you
data.
Don't, I mean.
Data. I mean, come on.
In a way, you don't really need, I mean, you could just have a wall mounted unit that essentially does the same thing, a lot of the same things if you're talking about a smart home or controlling right. a lot of the things. But I agree. I do think there's something about just the way human beings are that they like to see a.
Yeah.
a humanoid thing.
Well, so you make a really good point. So not only did we start to understand that Pepper can overcome some of those, you know, inherent human-to-human issues, but you know, Pepper has a presence because of its form factor. And I think that's something that we can't overlook. If Pepper were sitting here right now, our kinesthetic sense would be triggered.
Mm-hmm.
Like you would know Pepper is there.
Yeah. Is Pepper an acronym?
No, it's actually just a word that works really well in almost any language.
Oh, all right.
It's as simple as that.
Cool.
We have lots of urban legends internally about, no, it's actually Pepper Potts. Believe me, there's some really good stories that get better and better with a few drinks. But I think that's something that you can't overlook. So Alexa is amazing. You know, we have one in our house. I'm sorry, I'm pointing at nothing over here.
Oh,
they're all going, wait.
Zoom. Yeah,
you know, the Echo is a really amazing piece of hardware, but you forget it's in the room.
Right.
Right?
Isn't that unsettling? I haven't hooked mine up yet because I just
only
feel
if
like,
you're saying things that could get you in trouble.
No, but even if not,
three.
Even if not, it still just feels weird to have something in there where it could be a two-way device. It just feels unsettling to me. And I love technology. I love, love, love technology. But I still feel like, I don't know. That one feels a little strange to me.
Well, wait till Pepper's looking at you then. so you may not be our first target audience. Matt seems interested. We'll go with that.
Yeah, sure.
No, Pepper listen, if it was a robot, I probably would have no idea. Right. Like, oh, well, it's a robot. I got to let it in my house. Right. You know.
But I think that presence is something that's really important. So you're right. It could be wall-mounted, but it doesn't do the same thing. The reality is, so go back to the in-store thing I mentioned. You know, just counting people that walk by, there's lots of systems that mm-hmm. can do that. There's cameras, there's heat sensors, you can heat map. There's lots of things you can do just to count that. But that isn't going to engage you. That's not going to tell you a brand story. That's not going to be a sales associate. That's not going to answer your typical banal questions like, where's the restroom,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not going to help the store staff do their daily job. So the question becomes, how important is the form factor? And we've come to find that the form factor is almost everything mm-hmm. when it comes to the robot. So the fact that it's got fingers, the fact that we've programmed it just to look like it's breathing ever so slightly, the fact that it sneezes every so often just to remind you that it's there, like that's all really important.
That's so Japanese.
It's a little Japanese.
To really really understanding like how people, like what types of aesthetic qualities make people want to engage with something just feels like such a part of Japanese culture.
Well, you know,
which they've done that
absolutely.
Magically.
Absolutely. What's really interesting is it's the game designers that do so well with Pepper.
Mm.
So our studio in San Francisco is led by a guy that's a former Ubisoft, but he's a game designer and has been for a long time. Our former CTO and a couple of his team came from Ubisoft Paris, which is how I got to SoftBank. So, you know, the fact that you have to animate is something they're very used to, and they understand physics and how that impacts it. One of the things that we have to be careful of when we're training developers is, unlike your mobile device, you have to think about gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have Pepper waving its arms for an hour on end because you're going to blow out the motor. That's just the reality of robotics. And so you have to be aware of that, and you have to think about the physics of the motions that you're creating. And you know, mm-hmm. you can't get your arm from here to over here, you know, in no time. You have to think about the arc of that. And that's what game designers do inherently within their games. And they set up the physics and the engines in such a way to allow that. But we found that they take to it very quickly. And so back to in your home, you know, being able to program it to have the emotions that grant it presence, I think ultimately changes the game. Right?
Wow. I think just for another idea for the suggestion box, a robot head on a quadcopter. Because then it could just follow you all
this
around
is like,
the
this
house.
Is like gold, Chris.
Right? I'm serious.
And this shit will sell.
Then you don't have to worry about the robot body navigating anything. It's just the head. Sort of like, remember,
isn't that more terrifying?
Remember Robin Williams' head and Baron Munchausen, how they would become detached from the movie's good and you're wrong.
It was in Wild Wild West too, wasn't it? Wasn't
oh yeah, was it? Yeah,
his head come off.
Did that come off in Wild Wild West?
And then no, it goes on
to like a
body,
spider. Right?
His body was in a spider wheelchair. You know,
that's right.
Civil War technology.
But it was
why not?
But that idea that, you know, like putting the unit like just in like a flying face that follow. Okay, maybe that is kind of horrifying. Never mind.
Says the guy that feels like it's spooky that this device can listen to him, much less a face like staring at him crawling.
Well, did you see that video?
I don't trust Alexa. Put it on a quadcopter.
Did you see that video of a woman that she was standing over Alexa and she goes, Alexa, are you spying on me for the CIA? And then it shut down. And she goes, Alexa, and it came on, bloop. Are you spying on me for the CIA? Bloop. And then it shuts down because it won't lie to you.
Now they've updated it.
What does it do now?
It says
yes.
No, it says no. I work for Amazon.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Which
I asked my Alexa 2 days ago.
But then
I work for Abstergo.
But if Amazon is filing information, if they're just a pass through to the CIA, then that's still technically a truthful answer.
Well, then the CIA is going to know exactly when I'm out of dog food.
Yeah. And the reality is, it didn't know how to answer the question, so it didn't.
I guess that's true. Okay, all right, that's fine.
I mean, it really wasn't that sinister. It was just that's not what it's programmed. Now that they know that's a question, they've programmed the question to be answered.
What's the most fascinating thing that you've learned about human behavior? Is there anything about human behavior where you this whole process you're like, oh my god, it's
unlike the three things I've already told you?
Yes. Anything else?
I just the things that you feel comfortable talking to technology about. You know, I mean, I didn't really realize this. There's been studies done with patients doing PTSD recovery, and they're far more likely to open up to a robot or a device than they are to a person.
Oh, wow.
For whatever reason. And so that was really surprising to me. And again, I didn't grow up as a roboticist, so you know, I'm learning kind of as I go too. But those kinds of ahas are pretty profound, and I think they scratch at these bigger, broader questions you've been asking: is how do we want our technology to grow with us? Well, I think we have to determine what are our needs and start to make certain that the technology delivers towards those needs and adds value in that sense. And so it's not about them taking over the world or what have you. It's just about, it could be about having companionship. It could be about having somebody answer any question I can think of. It could be about, go switch the channel or put the cups away in the dishwasher. I think that's probably more the answer, certainly in the medium term.
But I kind of feel like there's an interesting parallel between robots and also giant companies, because I think people are sort of distrustful of things that aren't human. Like a company,
he just keeps going back to Skynet, doesn't he? That's exactly where he's going.
But people don't trust big companies,
I saw Westworld too.
So you saw it? Yeah,
it's impressive.
So, but at the core of it, when you strip it all away, well, companies made up of human beings.
That's right.
So it is a human organism because it's made up of but what is it about big companies that you think people are automatically distrustful of and like, wait a minute.
Well, because pop culture has led them there, right? I've been at small companies and I've been at big companies, and I mean, the premise that there's something evil going on gives way too much credit to these companies. There's so much shit going on they can barely get
right.
I mean, if you stop them, and you know this now because Nerdist is getting pretty big, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you get it,
modest,
and you need people to come in that can't do what you do to run the business, right? And it's everything they can do that because you're doing such a good job at what you're doing. You're growing so fast, right? Is there something sinister about what you're doing? Absolutely not. Right, you're doing what the people who are either paying for or the advertiser paying for want you to do.
Well, I mean, except for me just pretending to be a nerd so I could capitalize on the nerd.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute, Katie, cut that out.
We know how it is.
Fake nerd. Hashtag fake nerd.
But he's way too well dressed.
But you know what's interesting? I'm still wearing TV makeup.
No, he's a nerd with money. That's what they do.
But
they look cool.
I do think that people will write the scripts in their head about whatever they think is going, oh, well, it's got to be this, like if they don't know. So, what do you think large companies need to do to make people understand, like, hey, we're not trying to completely, take over your life and turn you into some sort of a indentured servant. It's like, what do you think companies, what is their responsibility to connect with people so to be trusted?
You have one little robot and these are the conversations. I never had these conversations dealing with batteries. I think this would be a quick example, right? Just being open and communicative to the broader world about what you're trying to do to the extent you can. And just saying, look, we have a vision. Here's what our vision is. In our case, we want to get a robot in everybody's home eventually. And we want to make people happy. Like it's pretty simple, right? How you do that, boy, it's actually a pretty big challenge. And we're still trying to figure out, how best to do that with the resources that we have. But we're constantly looking at technology companies. Silicon Valley is a great place to be. We're located in San Francisco. So great place to be to see what's coming and try to attach ourselves to that. But every step of the way, to the extent that we can be out there and communicating, I think helps. You know, we have a different problem with SoftBank in that the average North American probably doesn't still know who SoftBank is.
I know. I think most people probably go, "Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah,
I've heard that mentioned in the news."
Because lately, more so. But we like to kind of joke, it's the biggest $73 billion company nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
Here. Now, if you go to Asia, not a problem.
Sure. Right?
They know exactly who it is, and you know that because you travel quite a bit too. But you know, our bigger issue is how do we get the name SoftBank into the North American market, and the robotics is one way to do that because it's obviously gets a lot of attention, and you know, there's a lot of heft behind SoftBank. We own ARM, the chip design company, which Masayoshi Son, our CEO, just bought last year for $32 billion.
Mm-hmm.
They design most of the chips, certainly in this room. You have chips around you in arm's rank that ARM designed. They own robotics. They have AI-type companies. They have software companies. They have now a vision fund mm-hmm. of $100 billion that they're putting together over the next 5 years to go develop technologies.
Maybe so, it's the word bank that throws people off.
It absolutely is. So I won't name the company. I was at an event for this giant global consulting company who we've all heard of.
Okay.
And their partners are in this meeting. So they would come out of their sessions and then they could peruse some of the technology they brought in. We were one of them. And all day they kept going, "So tell me how you're using Pepper in banking."
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, you know, maybe this is the group within this consulting firm that deals with banking. And so they just keep asking this question. It was like 3 p.m. before I realized they thought we were literally a bank. And I'm like, why would a bank be here with a robot?
Yeah.
What? That's not what they do.
So this is an ATM that follows you around wherever you go?
Yeah.
Well, last year the Deutsche Bank guy was doing some weird stuff.
So it's a different. Yeah. It's totally different. So maybe in America it'll be like soft guys. No, that's a bad example.
Yeah, that's bad.
But I do think it's the word bank that makes people kind of scratch their head and think that exact.
Well,
same
originally
thing.
It was because Masa had a software company.
Your founder,
our founder, Masa had a software company whereby you could come there and buy any of the box discs. So whether it was Windows or, you know, all your favorite, you could come to one place and buy all of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So hence a bank for software.
Oh, interesting.
And so SoftBank. So it were, I mean, look, the guy's done a great job. So who are
probably,
we?
He's probably fine.
Who are we to say that was not a good choice?
He's doing okay.
Yeah. He's doing all
right. I just mean in terms of like, you know, just talking about in America, like what it is, like to get people to understand what that is. But I do think, you know.
But it's mostly, you're mostly B2B, right?
Right now, we're how we're bringing Pepper to market is that we're being very choiceful in making certain that we go to businesses first.
Yeah.
One, because we just feel like that's a much better way to get people used to the technology, to see it and understand it. And two, again, you know, if it's going to be in your house, it needs to have a meaningful suite of software.
Mm-hmm.
And so that needs to come. And certainly we're going to have software, but we won't have nearly enough to really satisfy what certainly people listening to this podcast are going to want out of a 4-foot-tall humanoid robot mm-hmm. if it appears in their living room, right? So we want to be choiceful in how we come to the market and give time for those developers we talked about to get the time to go develop the software that will end up being meaningful, right? So we're focusing on piloting first. Back to your beta point, we're piloting first with some companies that do a really good job of working with us and want to learn. So HMS Host, you know them well because of how much you travel. Everyone in your receipts says HMS Host. Westfield is their innovation centers in San Francisco, so it's really easy. They own a lot of malls around North America. And we have used Beta, which is a really interesting sort of new style of retail format. And those guys, one of the guys came from Nintendo, so it's not surprising that it's all coming back to gaming. See, you've been telling people for years it all comes back to gaming. But so those are the companies that we're starting with. And then when we're ready to launch more broadly, we'll have ideally a suite of software that say the Nerdist could use, and it could greet people at your front door and take the, you know, poor Katie doesn't have to wait for some schlup at the front gate to text her saying, "Hey, I'm here 45 minutes early." And she's like, "Shit, what do I do with this guy now?"
And then it could also record the podcast. And then, no, I don't mean you'd still.
Great.
I mean as the device, not as the producer. You're not being...
Poor Katie.
We're not going to replace you with a robot.
Classic factory owner talk.
We're not going to... We come in here and it's
old money bags over here. It's just,
we're going to come in and it's a Pepper robot and then down in Scout's bed is a Boston Dynamics robot just down on its side that could easily get back up at any time.
It could happen.
But I guess as we're sort of wrapping this up, do you have any advice for... I think... I did not go to school for marketing. I don't really entirely...
So the Anderson School is amazing.
The Anderson UCLA, School at UCLA is really amazing. I feel like comedian... I feel like all stand-ups, in a sense, are marketers because they essentially have to condense concepts and ideas and then convey them to an audience in a relatable way, which is very much what... advertising and marketing is, and I feel like that
you sell and market yourself.
I mean, in a way, yeah, I mean,
not intentionally, but that's just naturally what you do. So you're right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, comedians create catchphrases; they create things that are sticky to the audience so that they have an emotional reaction to something. I mean, it's basically that's what I came to realize is essentially what we do. We're like they're kind of ad men.
Does your manager not suggest not your literally, but does a manager not suggest those kinds of things? Is that not part of the industry?
You mean like learning marketing?
Like learning, you've got to have a catchphrase. You've got to, you've got to do those things.
I think that's sort of the old school.
You don't call it marketing, but.
Yeah, that's sort of the old school. You know,
you got to be sticky, Hardwick.
Yeah, kind of. I'm going to make you sticky. But that's kind of what they say in not so many. Like, what's your hook is what they would say to a comedian. Like, what's a hook? What do people take away when
the hook brings you back.
But on this, you can rely. I think is the response to that, but marketing itself, like what is something that you could say to people? Like, what do they need to understand in this world where people have to kind of be everything, you know, because that's just how it is now because of social media and the internet. So what are some basic things that people might not understand?
Yeah, it's funny. So as I think you recall, I told you I have a degree in geology. But
you understand marketing.
And it's serving me so well. So I went to grad school. I'm trying to come out, and I have no idea what to do. And, you know, they suggest at the career fair or whatever, go talk to your friends because they'll tell you what they see you doing. And so I went to go talk to my friends. And, like, to the person, they're like, oh, I see you in sales. And I was offended. I'm like, because I had, like, the double-breasted polyester suit guy that comes to your front door selling vacuum cleaners in my mind. And... you know, long story short, what I've come to realize over my career, and you know this well too, because you've started a company, is whether you are selling to Walmart or anybody, or internally an idea that you have, you're still selling, or even just to get a date, right? You're selling yourself. And so that skill actually is hugely valuable.
Well, I'm a gigolo.
So that is easier for you probably.
my wife doesn't know. I probably, yeah.
Well,
if I could get some marketing skills to sell her on why that's a good idea, that would be very helpful.
So anyway, I think the selling skills become really important. And back to your point about marketing, just getting
not juggalo.
No. Totally.
I was just trying to give you time to let those gears go. And what was the question?
No, but just some basic things that people could understand about marketing. Like something that demystifies it or something that makes it accessible or something that, you know, just simple ways to think about it.
And this is so much more mundane than your normal podcast. But I think the idea is, you know, you need to find something that's relevant to the person you're talking to. Because if it's relevant, then they'll engage. And if they're engaged, then that message gets through. So relevant is important. So go back to our original idea. If you're trying to stop somebody, you have 5 seconds from 5 feet. Then you need to deliver a message that's relevant. So perfect example, and this is kind of funny. So I used to work with Old Spice.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of Procter & Gamble's brands. The number one purchaser of Old Spice high endurance deodorant is a woman aged 35 to 54 because she's buying for her family.
Okay.
Because she's probably the one that's out there shopping. So if you know that, what's the message that you have to deliver at that moment in time? That's called the first moment of truth, right? So when you pull the item off the shelf, that's the first moment of truth. When you use it, that's the second moment of truth. So the user is not the same person often as the shopper. And so marketing is very much about just understanding at that moment in time what's relevant to that person and delivering a message that's relevant to them because then they'll engage. And I think that's true whether you're doing a stand-up routine to the crowd because you're listening and you're paying attention to the crowd and you start to get a sense of what they're about. and you start to modify your communication to them, right? I'm guessing, but
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, it's not actually rocket science in that sense, but it's funny how easy it is to miss that point. And then it's to the piece you said, which is, I hate it when people are wasting my time with messages that don't make sense to me.
Right. Well, it helps to listen to. It helps to pay attention.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of dollars spent trying to learn what's important to you so that they can deliver that message, right?
Yeah. You almost have to get just like that Sherlock thing where you walk into a room and you just see the data on everything at the same time.
That's AR, by the way.
That is AR. Yeah. That's absolutely
that's the
AR.
Sherlock AR. Write that down.
I wonder what we're going to do. I wonder what we're going to do with, you know, because essentially that our devices now are just these external drives that have freed up our brain space so that we don't have to essentially know or remember anything anymore. So what are we, I guess right now we seem to be replacing that with anxiety and depression and fear. So I wonder what we're going to do when we have that, you know, when that bandwidth gets opened up the more and more we rely on.
Yeah. I mean, I still think there's so much around the human piece to this. I mean, the fact that we would listen to this podcast. I mean, I've really enjoyed your podcast for the last several years. I think the first one I actually got exposed to you guys at South by Southwest when you interviewed John Oliver.
Oh yeah,
that was awesome.
That's funny. I just found that picture of us from back then. All of us looked like children, including John.
But you know, why did we go to see you instead of just wait for it to come out? Right? Because that was an experience.
You want the human experience?
Yeah. And Jack Black was in the back just heckling you. I don't know if you remember that, but I chatted with him. Not Jack Black. Ian Black. Michael Ian Black.
Michael Ian Black.
I mean, that's an experience, and I don't think you replace that with technology. I think technology can make life easier, but that's ideally it frees you up so you can have more of those experiences, I think.
Well, I hope that's true.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you guys for having
us. Pleasure. Is there anything you want to plug or what people, I mean, besides SoftBank, not a bank.
Not a bank.
Head to the Westfields in San Francisco.
Head to Westfield, head to Oakland Mall, and a lot more to come. But, you know, if you've got developers
Akihabara.
That listen, you know, we have a way to, you can download our SDK. You can play around with programming the robot in a virtual sense. You can see what you've done and how it reacts virtually. And so we encourage everybody to come check it out. And hopefully we'll be at Silicon Valley Comic Con. Maybe we'll be at your event.
The festival. Do you guys have, I bet this is something that people would love to know, is internships. Do you have an internship program for young roboticists or people who want to work in this field?
I wouldn't say that we have a specific program, but we absolutely have interns. So absolutely, you know, we'd love to see. We actually have a few open roles too around sales and business development. So if we've got folks that want to get into that side of it,
well, how should they contact? Who should they contact?
That is a great question. Can we get back to you? Maybe post it somewhere. Well, meatpepper.com wouldn't be a way to put your resume.
But she wants you to say
meatpepper.com.
But meatpepper.com is where everybody else should go. And then download the SDKs. And like we just said, you can learn how to program Pepper. But back to the internship, we'll need to figure out a way to let your people.
Great. That'd be great because I think people really would love to. A lot of people who listen are probably. This could be one of those moments where someone is going, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't. And then they hear everything that you're saying and go, holy shit, I need to figure out how to do that.
Well, that guy that came up to you and brought all those pictures at Sketchfest, right? That was pretty incredible.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. So this, you know, this is just for those people who feel like that something is particularly
resonant. One dev who's not working right now to download that SDK at meatpepper.com and program it to do everything we said can to do this yet.
Easy, right?
We have her just come in and sign off the podcast too. Does Pepper have a voice?
It does have a voice, yeah.
And do you program the voice or is it preordained?
No. We spend a lot of time thinking about the voice that it should have for the region. So it's a slightly different tone in Japan and slightly different tone in Europe. But, I mean, it's important that it has the right accent, right?
And I am Pepper!
So it's not that.
What? Are you
sure? That would be an example of what it is not.
Hello, what can I do for you?
I'd like that.
And he drinks Duff.
Oh, yeah. That did skew Barney.
Yeah.
A little,
hey, everybody. I'm Pepper the Robot. Let's enjoy a burrito.
Thanks, Pepper.
Can I say enjoy your burrito?
Yeah, you should.
Because I've been practicing my announcer voice, like, you know, Danny, Donnie, Joe, John, and Jordan, the new kids on the block. So, enjoy your burrito.
Yes!
Thank you.
Here we go.
Thank you.
MeatPepper.com.
Thank
you.
MeatPepper.com.
That was awesome.
Soon to be heard, producing the Nerdist podcast.
So,
wait, what?
And this.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.